Happy Friday. It is Friday, April 10th, 2026, and my name is Linda. Thanks for joining me at the Talking Information Center this morning to read 30 minutes of the Patriot Ledger. I'm going to start on the front page. Bring this forward for public review. Is City of Quincy an easy embezzlement target? By Peter Blandino. In Quincy, City Council is seeking answers from Mayor Tom Koch's administration about how former Elder Services Director Tom Clasby defrauded the city of around $150,000. Koch fired Clasby in May of 2024 amid a police investigation. At the April 6 meeting, Ward 6, City Councilor Deborah Riley introduced a resolve calling for a, quote, comprehensive review of the city's purchasing, accounting, human resources, municipal finance, and information technology processes to identify and address any vulnerabilities or gaps that allowed for the misuse of public funds. After initially pleading not guilty after his January 2025 arrest, Clasby pleaded guilty in federal court to 12 counts of theft and fraud on March 9, 2026. Investigators said he embezzled more than $144,000, between 2020 and 2024, spending the stolen money on personal expenses, including 153 pounds of bourbon steak tips, 170 hours in a Weymouth music recording studio singing songs for his wife and others, 27 fleece vests emblazoned with the words Men of Divine Mercy, a men's prayer group led by Mayor Koch and other top city officials, cleaning services and a Toyota Prius for a longtime female friend, a $1,658 lacquered and framed self-portrait he intended to give to his wife Clasby, Clasby falsified purchase orders, funneled money through a fake New York City contractor, and stole at least $84,000 in cash directly from the senior center safe, prosecutors said. Riley said she was reintroducing, with slight alterations, a resolve first brought forward by former City Council President Ian Kane in January of 2025. At that time, criminal proceedings against Clasby had just gotten underway, which prevented a full discussion of the matter, Riley said. It is time now to bring this forward for public review, Riley said. Chris Walker, Koch's chief of staff, said the administration is proud of how it handled a bad situation. Walker said he didn't know if documents can legally be released and the matter open to discussion now that Clasby has pleaded guilty, or if that will have to wait until after his June sentencing. Riley's resolve also recommends an independent consultant or auditor to assist the review and provide recommendations to strengthen and enforce safeguards. It passed unanimously and was referred to the Finance and Oversight Committees. The Finance Committee could take it up as early as April 13th, its next scheduled meeting. Next up on the front page, triumph or tragedy? Marshfield radio personality loves to tell a story, by Ruth Thompson. In Marshfield, Christine James was recovering from knee surgery when a neighbor who volunteered at the, here we go, Talking Information Center, a radio reading service that's dedicated to the visually impaired, said the Marshfield organization was looking for volunteers with radio experience. It was while she was volunteering there in 1990 that she encountered Ed Perry, the larger-than-life founder and president of radio station WATD 95.9, which is in the same building on Enterprise Drive. When I first met Ed Perry, he was younger and crazier than he is now, James said with a laugh in a recent interview. The door was open between the offices, and he was yelling into the phone to his son about older boys lighting firecrackers in the basement. He slams down the phone, runs out the door, jumps into his car, and burns rubber home to Duxbury. Perry found out about James's radio background and talked to her about joining the station. He lured me to the dark side, James said. I said I'd give it 3 months. This October, I'll be here 36 years. A Philadelphia native, James got her start in radio while living in Texas. My mother always said, if you find a place where you want to be, get your foot in the door and let them get to know you and see what you can do and then ask for things, she said. So I started volunteering for a fundraising event at a National Public Radio, NPR affiliate, answering phones. My second day, some guy doesn't show up, so they asked me if I could fill in on the air. I guess they thought I had a pretty good voice. She filled in again the next day, and when he didn't show for a third day, she got the job. Though she said it was a great experience, it was tough working in broadcasting at a time when women were not given hard stories. I could have worked in TV in my 20s, but back then, your career was done at 35, she said. In radio, if you're a good reporter and sound good, you can work until the cows come home. After she and her husband moved to New England and settled on the South Shore, James, who holds a degree from Vassar College, worked as a sales rep for a fashion company. Then came WATD. When she first started with us, she was writing ads and stuff, and it was very clear she could write wonderfully, Perry said of James. She's very focused. She understands how to take a story people might not understand and make it so people can understand it. Before long, James was on the air and working with news director Bob Stone. He's a great guy, she said. Working with Bob was like going to graduate school. I learned a lot from him. I always try to learn from the people I work with. That includes Perry, with whom she occasionally spars. Our big blowout fights are worse than an Italian opera, she said. But he knows I'll do the right thing. Said Perry, she's tough, really tough. If she thinks something has to be done a certain way, you better do it, believe me. James has always put her boots on the ground. She says pulling things off the internet is plagiarism and thinks it's frightening that a lot of opinion online is being taken as fact. Vetting sources and information is so important, she said. We're a different kind of news organization. We're not a rip and read. We're real journalists who happen to work at a radio station. We have to be able to write like the newspaper guys, but also have to sound good on the air. Despite calling radio the redheaded stepchild of broadcasting, James loves it. It's so interesting, she said. There is such a demand for local news. I could hire 5 more people and keep them busy 24/7 and still not get it all. Every day is like triage. Which story can we cover? Over the years, James has covered some tragic stories, including high-profile murders. Our attitude is, we're here to support the victims, she said. Sometimes they get forgotten in the hustle and bustle, and their stories fade away. She recalls the murder of Melissa Gozul, a 27-year-old Randolph native who accepted a ride in July of 1999 from a Halifax man after her car broke down near the Sagamore Bridge. Gosul's body was found later in Pembroke. Everyone was searching for her for a long time, James said. Volunteers, including searchers on horseback, were at Miles Standish State Forest. Her parents were there. That was the same day John F. Kennedy Jr.'s plane crashed, and all the reporters that were at the forest took off to cover the plane crash, except WATD. Ed said, "We made a commitment to this family, and we'll stick by them. They're locals, they're our people." But in addition to heartbreaking stories, there are those that warm the heart as well. A James favorite was about a stash of toys from the 1950s that had been found in a Scituate rental property. "I tracked down the owner and did a story about it," she said. "I had music from that era. The woman was so surprised that someone who didn't know her would go to the trouble of tracking her down." Creating stories that have a positive impact on people are the most satisfying, James said. We're not taking a stand on things. We're just shining a light on things that people might not be aware of, she said. James noted that WATD is a very unique place, but in the end, we produce a good product. We're a dinosaur in this industry, but we're a dinosaur that works. And last up on the front page, for the foodies, 5 Bites of South Shore Food News to Devour by Jessica Trufant. Smashburgers and elevated hot dogs, a bottomless brunch, and a spot with a menu featuring sample dishes from chefs all over the country. These are just some of the exciting new options available on the South Shore. We're hungry just thinking about them. And if you missed last week's stories, click here, well, for the 411 on Foodie News. Also, check out the inside of Leo's Events and Restaurant in Braintree, which recently opened its doors. Plus, find out when some of the South Shore's regional spots are opening their doors. New ice cream burger joint set to open in Marshfield. Sunday Society is set to open at 1810 Ocean Street in Marshfield in the coming days. Most recently, Manny's Pizzeria, the new restaurant, will serve smash burgers, sundaes, and hot dogs. The property has seen plenty of turnover since going up in the mid-1970s. Locals will remember it before Manny's as Captain Mac's Seafood and Caswell's Seafood, and with plenty of colorful stripes, of course. Sunday Society is leaning into a vintage American ice cream parlor vibe with black and white checkered floors, neon signs, and an old school payphone on the wall. Outside has the same black and white theme with two large cow statues that double as benches. Some of the menu items include the Sunrise Dog, which is a bacon-wrapped dog, crispy hash brown crumbles, fried egg, spicy ketchup, and a drizzle of maple syrup for $9.99. The Spicy Bandit Smash Burger with pepper jack cheese, pickled onions, sliced jalapenos, lime crema, and tortilla strips for $8.99. And loaded tater tots with shredded cheese, bacon, scallions, and ranch drizzle for $7.99. Manny's closed abruptly last year, and the site sold in July for about $810,000. Speaking of ice cream, Hornstra Farms Norwell Ice Cream Bar announces season opening date. It's a true sign of spring when Hornstra opens its Norwell ice cream stand. The Hornstra family has maintained and expanded its dairy delivery service, ice cream, and other offerings made fresh from the cows at its farm in Norwell for more than 100 years. The stand, or dairy bar, as Hornstra calls it, will open for another season of scooping its homemade ice cream on Monday, April 13th. Anyone up for a scoop of raspberry cheesecake ice cream? Yum. Hornstra Farms is located at 246 Prospect Street in Norwell and 60 Bedford Street, which is Route 18, in Whitman. New Asian fusion restaurant opens in Randolph. Moon Bay, an Asian fusion restaurant with an emphasis on Hunan cuisine, is open at 8 Mazeo Drive in Randolph. The restaurant China Chef previously occupied the space. The menu features handmade dumplings, wok-fired dishes, and slow-simmered specialties like the signature lamb soup. The restaurant is open 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Monday through Sunday. Mason's Steakhouse in Quincy now has a bottomless brunch. Did someone say bottomless brunch? Mason's Steakhouse is offering an all-you-can-eat breakfast buffet from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. every Sunday, besides Mother's Day. The buffet includes traditional brunch items like hand-carved prime rib and a make-your-own omelet station. Add a mimosa and you're good to go. The buffet is $49 for those 13 and older, $15 for kids ages 6 to 12. There is no a la carte menu at brunch. Mason's Steakhouse is located at 1170 Hancock Street in Quincy. A sort of food hall opens new location in Canton. Wonder, a New York City-based fast food chain serving meals that allows customers to mix and match menu items from local restaurants and national chefs, is now open at the Village Shops at 95 Washington Street in Canton. Wonder restaurants serve meals from across the country by licensing recipes from each individual restaurant. Wonder prepares the meals at its New Jersey facility, and they're heated and served at each location. Wonder also partners with chefs to create meals that are only available at Wonder restaurants. There are a dozen of options at Wonder in Canton, including Emmaus Haitian Restaurant, Detroit Brick Pizza, and Mr. D's Fried Chicken. Wonder in Canton is open daily, 10:30 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. and offers delivery, takeout, and dine-in options. It's Wonder's 9th location in Massachusetts. Next up in the local column, lawyer. Clancy may admit to killing her children, by Hannah Morse. Lindsay Clancy may admit to the act of killing her three young children in 2023 if her trial can be split in two phases, her attorney said. But legal experts say this would not be an admission of criminal responsibility. The 35-year-old Duxbury woman's trial on charges that she strangled her children to death is scheduled to start on July 20th. Clancy has pleaded not guilty. On March 30th, Plymouth Superior Court Judge William Sullivan rejected a defense request to hold a two-phase or bifurcated trial. As Clancy's attorney, Kevin Reddington, requested, prosecutors would first have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Clancy is guilty of three counts of strangulation and murder, and to what degree. Then, they would have to prove that Clancy was not suffering from a mental disease or defect, so much so that she was unable to appreciate the criminality of her conduct or conform her conduct to the requirements of the law. In rejecting the defense's bifurcation request, Sullivan said that a two-phase trial was unnecessary because many issues presented in each phase would overlap and therefore be redundant. A defendant also does not have a constitutional right to a bifurcated trial. Reddington has asked the judge to reconsider. He said in the April 2nd motion that Clancy is, quote, willing to stipulate formally in writing to her involvement in the underlying conduct resulting in the death of the three young children. If that happens, the only live issue at trial will be the defendant's state of mind as it relates to the defense of lack of criminal responsibility, Reddington wrote. The Patriot Ledger could not reach Reddington for comment. But three Massachusetts legal experts who are not connected to the case weighed in on what this could mean. Guilty versus criminal responsibility in the Lindsay Clancy case. A little coffee. First, there is a difference between guilt and criminal responsibility. If a bifurcated trial were to go forward, Clancy agrees to admit that her actions did kill the children. So she would essentially be accepting a guilty verdict in the first trial phase without contest, said Rebecca Dunlea, assistant professor in the School of Criminology and Justice Studies at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. But she would not admit to criminal responsibility, which would be the topic of the second trial. That's because there's the issue of an insanity defense, also known as a lack of responsibility, said David Rossman, emeritus professor of law at Boston University Law School. The offer to stipulate to the underlying facts would establish just part of what's necessary to convict. Crimes like homicide require not only action, but a mental state like intent, Rossman said. What someone did is only part of the picture. Once this lack of responsibility is raised by the defense, it's up to the prosecution to prove that Clancy doesn't qualify, he added. Specifically, prosecutors will need to prove that Clancy understood right from wrong and had the ability to regulate her behavior at the time of the offenses, Dunlea said. The burden is always on the prosecution, but Clancy's defense attorney wants to avoid jurors conflating whether she committed the criminal behavior, which is pertinent for the first phase, with whether she's legally responsible for it or what the second phase would focus on, Dunlea said. Why would Lindsay Clancy want a split trial? Real risk that a jury would be so shocked and appalled. Bifurcated trials, not an unheard-of request, but not a very common request, said Chris Dearborn, clinical professor of law at Suffolk University Law School and the director of the Suffolk Defenders Program. The prosecution does not have to accept a stipulation, he noted. Kevin Reddington is an incredibly experienced, talented, and creative lawyer, Dearborn said. He's trying to do the best he can for his client. By seeking a two-phase trial, Dearborn said the defense might also be looking to reduce the amount of potentially inflammatory evidence that would be presented to the jury. You want the jury to fairly assess the issue of criminal responsibility on its own merits, even if the evidence of the conduct is interwoven with that, Dearborn said. There's a real risk that a jury will be so shocked and appalled by what happened that it might influence their ability to be completely impartial on assessing whether the criminal responsibility of the defendant is viable or not. Further, certain evidence that is allowed in one phase might be excluded in another, Dunlea said, though the prosecution has stated that their case would be similar for both parts. Ordinarily, if facts are established by a stipulation, the judge won't allow either party to introduce evidence that only goes to establishing those facts, Rosman said. It would not be relevant to any live issue. Otherwise, a single-phase trial would result in one verdict that considers if Clancy is guilty of committing the offenses and if she is criminally responsible. But prosecutors have already indicated they are against bifurcation, pointing to the same issues that would be in Sullivan's denial order. Man stabs off-leash dog after it attacked him, man tells police, by Jessica Trufant. The man said he stabbed a dog that attacked him Monday morning in Milton, according to state police. Massachusetts State Police troopers, Milton Police, and Milton Animal Control responded to the area of 46 Blue Hill River Road in the Houghton Pond Recreation Area about 11:30 a.m. Monday for reports of a man attacked by a dog, Trooper Leah O'Connell said in an email. The man told police that he stabbed the dog during the attack. The dog was off its leash at the time of the incident. Police said the dog was stabbed in its neck and taken to a nearby veterinary clinic for treatment. It is expected to survive. The man who was attacked and stabbed the dog has not been charged, police said. The incident remains under investigation by Milton Animal Control. Weymouth police seek help identifying two dogs found dead. The Weymouth Animal Control officer is trying to identify two dogs recently found dead on the shoreline of Whitman's Pond, including one that appears suspicious. Weymouth police said a medium-sized black and white pit bull mixed dog was found along the shoreline in the Lakeshore Road neighborhood on Monday, April 6th. The dog was wrapped in a plastic bag and had no identifying collar, tags, or microchip. The circumstances surrounding this dog's recovery are considered suspicious, and we are actively seeking information from the public, police said. A small white terrier-type dog was found dead along the shoreline of Whitman's Pond near the gazebo on Middle Street on Sunday, April 5th. This dog also had no identifying tags, collar, or microchip, only a flea and tick collar. Police said there were no signs of trauma or reasons to believe the death was suspicious. We simply hope to locate the owner and provide them with closure, police said. Those with any information should contact Animal Control Officer Darren King at 781-660-3707. In other news, U.S.-Iran ceasefire on tenuous ground. Israel continues attacks on Lebanon. For USA Today, President Donald Trump's ceasefire with Iran was on tenuous ground on April 9th after Israel launched its deadliest day of strikes on Lebanon yet, and Tehran vowed not to desert its allies. A day after announcing the Iran war ceasefire, Trump took to social media to warn the country that if the, quote, real agreement was not complied with, all U.S. military assets would remain in place ready for a military response. He warned Iran to keep the Strait of Hormuz open and safe, but did not address the strikes in Lebanon in the Post. Quote, if for any reason it is not, which is highly unlikely, then the shooting starts bigger and better and stronger than anyone has ever seen before, he wrote. Meanwhile, strikes in Lebanon, which borders Israel, came on April 8th. a day after United States and Iranian leaders announced a break in hostilities to hold peace talks and for oil shipments through the Strait of Hormuz to resume, a key breakthrough in the agreement. But in the wake of Trump's announcement, parties involved were soon at odds over whether the break in fighting included Lebanon. The Iran-U.S. ceasefire terms are clear and explicit. The U.S. must choose ceasefire or continued war via Israel. It cannot have both, Iran's Foreign Minister Sayed Abbas Araghchi said in a statement as bombs hit Beirut. On April 8th, Israel carried out its largest bombardment of Lebanon since the start of the war, killing over 250 people, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. While Hezbollah initially halted fire following the announcement of the ceasefire, it has since responded to the Israeli attacks by firing rockets at northern Israel. Israeli strikes killed between 180 and 260 people and left around 1,000 people wounded in Lebanon on April 8th, local authorities reported. The death toll in the country bordering Israel is the highest yet for a single day of the war. Lebanon's health ministry reported 182 deaths. The country's civil defense service reported 254. The two authorities reported around 1,000 people injured. Beirut saw the worst of the strikes. Israeli strikes killed 91 people in Lebanon's capital city, the civil defense service said. Residents said attacks came without warnings to evacuate. Videos shared by reporters of strikes on Lebanon's capital city show rubble sent flying as buildings were destroyed. Authorities in Tehran have posted flyers in stations in the city's train system, vowing that the country will not leave Lebanon alone, Iranian state media reported. And unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time with the Patriot Ledger. Have a wonderful weekend.